Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, let's do it again. Let's practice our American English reading and speaking skills together. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we will practice with two stories. First, we will travel to Africa to hear how some large animals are causing problems. People want to protect the animals, but a solution to their problems must be found. Then, there may be dangers in your home that you are not even aware of. Cooking and heating are involved. But you'll have to stay with us for 10 minutes to find out the rest. Let's get started with part one. Some of the world's biggest animals are causing harm to villagers in the far north of Cameroon. Villagers say hundreds of elephants and hippopotamuses have caused major damage to farms and destroyed their villages. They say all this took place during the past 3 months. Cameroon's government says the elephants and hippopotamuses have killed several people. But officials and wildlife organizations warn against killing the animals. Both are protected species. Jerry Watson takes the story from there.
Ludu Amadu of Bugai Village says he has lost all of his crops to the animals. He says the elephants and hippos have destroyed all his sorghum and onions and continue to attack people in their villages. And he says the elephants are destroying property in at least 5 villages in his area every day. The animals are leaving the overcrowded 4,000 hectares of Kalfu Wildlife Park for areas with more food. And Quenty Simon Doe is the most senior administrative official in the area. He says increased human population is responsible for changing parts of the park to farms and villages. That means reduced natural resources. Mr. Doe says the elephants and hippos from Gear Lake near the park have already killed several people. He says wildlife officials have killed 3 hippos that carried out raids. He says he called on villagers not to kill the animals. He notes that they will enjoy huge social and economic benefits if they help protect the enormous animals. Alexandre Brochet is with the World Wildlife Fund for Nature. He says the elephant population in the rainforest has decreased by 60% in the past 10 years. He says people must understand that if they do not stop killing the elephants, there might not be wildlife in the forest in 10 or 20 years.
Cameroon and the wider Congo Basin. It's one of the world's natural treasures. It's the second largest rainforest in the world. And we are losing our big mammals, our great emblematic mammals like the elephants.
Soné Koké is with Trade Response Assessment and Priority Setting, a non-governmental organization. He rejects claims that international organizations prefer protecting animals to attending to the needs of people.
Well, you know, there's always this misconception that structures, organizations, or even some government agencies are more interested in animals than people. Of course not. We are talking of global resources. Maybe in the next 20 years, we will not have elephants in Cameroon. So how are we going to act on that? Maybe in the next 10 years, we'll not have lions in Cameroon. Black rhinoceros are virtually extinct in Cameroon. So that's what we are talking about. So if nothing is being done, we are going to lose all those resources.
Wildlife groups have been urging Cameroon to declare a policy of absolutely no killing of animals to prevent their possible disappearance from Earth. I'm Jerry Watson.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Did you know that smoky cook stoves are a leading cause of indoor air pollution, poor air quality inside buildings? Indoor air pollution kills more than 4 million people each year. The problem is bigger than malaria, tuberculosis, or HIV, the virus that causes the disease AIDS. Recently, people concerned about the issue met for 2 days of discussions in New York City. Their hope was to persuade private industry to build and sell better stoves. Christopher Cruz tells us more.
Traditional open fire cooking affects the health of both human beings and the world's environment. Collecting wood for cooking fires is one of the main causes of deforestation. And the gases and soot that come from the fires pollute the air. They also are partly responsible for rising temperatures. At the meeting, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton noted that almost 3 billion people use traditional stoves for heating and cooking. Because of their widespread use, she said, indoor air pollution is an international problem.
But it also, if approached correctly, could be an economic opportunity. And that is the idea behind the alliance.
The Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves supports companies that make and sell affordable, efficient, and less polluting cookers. The alliance also supports research into developing better stoves. Ms. Clinton helped launch the group in 2010. At the meeting, the United States promised $200 million in financial support and research money, but organizers wanted to raise $500 million. Radha Muthiah is the executive director of the alliance. She says 4 years after the group was launched, 20 million more households are using clean cookstoves.
We've proven that this market-based approach works. 20 million stoves later, we know that this is a recipe that can be scaled up.
Jim Jetter works as a researcher for the United States Environmental Protection Agency. He says it is not easy to build a low-cost device that people will use.
It's a big technical challenge to make a cook stove that has low emissions of air pollutants, that is fuel efficient, and that is low cost so that people can afford it. And most importantly, that it meets the user needs. If it doesn't meet the user's needs, then people don't use the stoves, and then there are no benefits.
In 2012, improved stoves were tested at 15,000 homes in Orissa, India. Laboratory tests showed that the stoves lowered indoor air pollution. Harvard University economist Rima Hanna helped to write a report on the study.
They slowly fell into disrepair, and households continued to use the traditional cooking stoves as well.
The study found that homes with the new stoves were no healthier than those with traditional ones, and they did not use less fuel. Radha Muthiah says members of the alliance know that it is not easy to solve the cook stove problem. She says the group is studying how people use them.
There have been a lot of failures. Success takes a little bit longer, you know, to show, but we're seeing that, and so that definitely inspires me.
The alliance says it wants 100 million more homes to have clean cookstoves by 2020. The group believes it will reach that goal early. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Getting a good education and good jobs have long been issues for Native Americans, many of whom live in poverty. Now, President Barack Obama has announced a plan to better prepare young American Indians for colleges and careers. The announcement came as part of the recent White House Tribal Nations Conference in Washington. In June, Mr. Obama and his wife Michelle visited the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. The new plan is called the Generation Indigenous Initiative. It calls for the Department of the Interior to provide $1.2 million to help six more tribes establish school systems run by the tribes. It also increases programs for teaching science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and efforts to keep native languages from dying out. More than 30% of Americans have graduated from college. At the same time, only about 10% of American Indians are college graduates. Lewis Walking Elk, however, is studying for a master's degree in environmental science at Sitting Bull College in North Dakota. He wants to use the degree to help people who live on his reservation. He's one of the first in his family to go to college.
My dad especially, he didn't finish high school, and he always was like, hey, you gotta do something.
Sitting Bull College is one of more than 30 tribal colleges in the United States. About 300 students are completing their higher education at the school. The federal government provides support for the program. Sitting Bull College President Laurel Vermillion says the goal of making sure students finish their college studies is all important to her.
A huge majority are first-generation students, college students who don't have a lot of experience. They don't have parents who can tell them or talk about, you know, college. And so when they leave the reservation and go onto these big mainstream campuses, they're lost.
Ms. Vermillion says many young Native Americans, especially men, are looking for direction and a sense of purpose. Today, 30% of students are male and 70% are female. Sitting Bull College is trying to appeal to more men by offering a technical program. Classes include welding and oil drilling. Scott Davis leads the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission. He also works to gain more male college students. He helps tribal colleges to get millions of dollars to start programs that develop young men for the workforce. Mr. Davis calls tribal colleges a shining beacon on reservations, giving hope to young Native Americans of a life of possibilities and an escape from poverty. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report for today. I'm Jerry Watson. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By 1863, America's northern states and southern states had been fighting a bitter civil war for 2 years. Both sides felt the pressure of the costly struggle. The South was beginning to suffer from a lack of supplies and men for its armies. The North was beginning to suffer from a lack of fighting spirit. This week in our series, Larry West and Tony Riggs describe an anti-war movement that was growing.
Many Americans in northern states did not support the war policies of Union President Abraham Lincoln. Some said openly that they did not care who won the war. They just wanted to be left alone. Coal miners in Pennsylvania protested against a law drafting men into the Union Army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to Pennsylvania to put down the riots. Farmers in Ohio also protested. They refused to be drafted. They attacked soldiers who were sent to arrest them. The worst anti-war riots, however, took place in New York City.
On July 13th, 1863, a crowd formed outside a New York draft office. Inside, Army officials were choosing the names of men who would be taken into the Army. Each name was written on a separate piece of paper. The papers were mixed together in a big box. The officials then began to remove the papers, one at a time. They made a list of the names. These were the men of New York who must go off to fight. On that day, however, the list was never completed. The crowd outside the draft office became louder. There were shouts of protest against the draft and against the Civil War.
Suddenly, a stone crashed through the office window. Then another, and another. The army officials escaped, but a policeman inside could not get away. The rioters beat him badly. Then they set fire to the draft office and several buildings nearby. The riot spread across the city. The riot began as a political protest against the draft. Poor men opposed the draft because it permitted rich men to escape military service. The law said a man who was drafted could stay out of the army by doing one of two things. He could pay the government $300, or he could pay another man to serve in his place. If a drafted man could not do either thing, then he must join the army or be shot as a deserter.
In the wartime economy of the North, prices were rising much faster than wages. Even a man with a good job had a difficult time feeding his family. It was impossible for him to pay the government $300 or pay someone else to serve for him in the army. Poor men protested against the law. They said it was unfair. "It's a rich man's war," they cried, "but a poor man's fight. The rich man's money against the poor man's blood."
There was something else that deeply troubled working men in the North. Anti-war activists told them that the war was not being fought to save the Union, but to free Negro slaves. The activists said the freed Negroes would move north and take jobs away from whites. Many men believed this. They said they would not fight.
Then, on July 13th, the angers and fears of working men in New York exploded. Their attack on the draft office that day was just the beginning. The violence lasted 3 days. The rioters beat many policemen to death. They beat, burned, and hanged every Negro they could find. They also killed many whites who tried to protect the Negroes. By the time soldiers stopped the rioting, 1,000 persons had been killed.
The leaders of the anti-war movement in the North were members of the opposition Democratic Party. They wore on their coats a copper penny showing the head of a Native American Indian. This gave them the name Copperheads. One important Copperhead was a former congressman from Ohio, Clement Vallandigham. Vallandigham made a speech criticizing the Union government. He was charged with violating a military law that banned such criticism. He was arrested.
The former congressman was taken before a military court. He objected. He said if he had broken a law, he should be tried by a civilian court. He demanded this as his constitutional right. The military judges rejected his argument. They found him guilty, and they sentenced him to remain in a Union military prison until the end of the war. People throughout the North were angry. Many did not support Clement Vallandigham's ideas, but they supported his right to speak freely. President Lincoln could approve or reject Vallandigham's sentence. His decision would show which issue was more important, the citizens' right to free speech or national security.
Lincoln was a good politician and a smart lawyer. He found an unexpected way to deal with the problem. He neither approved nor rejected the sentence. He changed it. Lincoln ordered Vallandigham to be turned over to the Confederate Army. Then he explained that Vallandigham had not been arrested for criticizing the government. His arrest was made, Lincoln said, because he was trying, with some success, to prevent men from entering the army. He was urging soldiers already in the army to leave it. Mr. Vallandigham was not arrested because he was damaging the political chances of the administration or the interests of the commanding general, but because he was damaging the army, upon which the life of the nation depends. The Confederates welcomed the anti-war leader. They helped him get to Canada. Vallandigham continued his anti-war campaign from there.
President Lincoln was troubled by the anti-war movement and violent opposition to the draft laws. He felt he had to make citizens understand why such laws were necessary. He prepared a speech which explained his thoughts. "There can be no army without men," Lincoln wrote. "Men can be had only with their permission or without it. We can no longer get enough men willingly, so there is a draft. If you dispute this and declare that men are still willing to serve in the army, then prove it by volunteering yourselves in large numbers. Then I will give up the draft."
Lincoln never gave this speech. He felt it was too direct. Instead, he gave a different kind of speech to the people of the Union. "You want peace," Lincoln said, "and you blame me that we do not have it. But how can we get it? There are but three ways possible. First, to put down the Southern Rebellion by force of arms. This I am trying to do. Are you for it? If you are, then we are so far agreed. If you are not for it, a second way is to give up the Union. I am against this. Are you for the Union? If you are, you should say so clearly. If you are not for force and not for dissolving the Union, there only remains some kind of compromise. I do not believe any such compromise is possible."
Politicians urged President Lincoln to investigate the anti-war protests in New York to learn who had led them. He refused. Lincoln believed that starvation would be like lighting a barrel of gunpowder. He already was fighting a bitter struggle against rebels in the South. He did not want to fight the people of the North, too. Southern leaders were pleased with the Copperheads' anti-war movement. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Tony Riggs. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.